Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Want to witness the world's biggest football game? Head to iCanWin.com.au, predict Australia's score with a crystal ball, and it could be you and a friend at the FIFA World Cup Qatar 2022 semi-finals, all thanks to McDonald's. Maccas, together and loving it. TNCs apply.
But a champion becomes a legend. Mackay Deaver has won it.
Perkins goes in first. What a legend. What a champion.
Welcome to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals.
As always, great to have your company for another edition of This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Today we celebrate the sporting life of a man who played more than 200 games for his beloved Saints. He had a couple of interesting records along the way. He made it to the big dance, all the way to the big dance on a couple of occasions. His name is Jason Blake and he joins me in the studio. Jason, good to see you.
Great to be here.
How are you travelling? You looking well?
Good. No, enjoying life after football, watching the mighty Saints go around. It's 5 years now, so
yeah.
It's gone pretty quick.
Did the feeling, once you got away from football and being in that bubble and having to go through training all the time and seeing the same people all the time, did you miss that time at the club instantaneously when you left football? Was it a really big wrench for you? Because a lot of people find it very hard to cope with in the first 12 months.
It certainly is really different and it takes some adjusting. You go from this environment that's completely focused on one particular goal. The whole organisation is really promoting and driving towards the ultimate. And then you come out into this world that have different agendas, different meanings, and all of a sudden you're left with a sense of, geez, I really need to drive my own agenda and drive a personal goal that is, I guess, separated from a greater one. And so it was really my search for something outside of football was to be a part of something unique and to be a part of something greater than myself. And that I felt was a great challenge and one that took some time to search for.
So it really is a matter of self-motivating yourself, because when you're in the football club environment, you've got so many people who are invested in that very thing. But once you make the break and once you step outside of that, well, you're your own boss. You've got to do it yourself.
Yeah, it's certainly it's a big change. And I was lucky enough to spend some time in the commercial world before I left, and lucky enough to leave on my own terms. So it gave me some time to prepare for that. But for those guys that's come clean out of the AFL system, it's a huge transition, and you know, when you're playing, everyone is your friend, and everyone wants to be a part of your journey and your life, and I found personally that those things change pretty quickly, and once you thought you could rely on someone to perhaps give you an opportunity, It dilutes pretty quickly, and whilst they're there to potentially support you, the opportunities aren't as frequent as you'd like.
Does that change your perceptions of people? Do you then look at them and think, well, while I was there and while I was in the limelight and while I had something to offer, you were there, but you've moved away pretty quickly after that?
I don't think so. For me, I can understand why. Personally invested in the St Kilda Football Club, and they've got a big interest in that. For them to transition to look outside that personally impacts their business or their underlying profit or whatever it is, it's a different story. And I can understand the sensitivities behind that. And it's just a matter of convincing whoever it was that I was talking to that well, I can actually add value beyond my experience in a certain field. So coming out of the AFL system when I was 32, I was certainly behind in perhaps many fields, but certainly ahead in a lot of others. So it was about trying to position myself in the best manner, in the best light.
The fact that you were involved in the business world before you left football and you had a bit of a foothold there for life after footy, is that something that you would advise younger guys who are coming up through the ranks to dabble in that, and rather than just be focused on football 24/7?
I really enjoyed it. For me, it was an escape from football. Different conversations, different priorities, different agendas. And whilst football was always there, for me, I really enjoyed it. I was lucky enough to actually have a year out in university before I got drafted. So I was able to establish some networks and get myself familiar with the university RMIT that I went to. And that really, I found, held me in good stead going forward throughout my football career to go back and keep studying and leverage those type of contacts. I found that the guys that didn't study, some were very fortunate in that they were great players and go into the media and go into different avenues. But there's others that it's just disastrous, and it's gut-wrenching to see them struggle after football.
The level of professionalism required, you're qualified to speak on this because you were in the system at the top level for 14 years. It was a very professional game when you came in, but even more so and even more time-consuming by the time you ended your career.
When I first came in, so Tim Watson was the coach, and we had school cubicles outside of the Raven facility, so it certainly wasn't as professional as it is now in terms of resourcing and time commitments. But I think it was transitioning to that. So there was still enough time back in the day to spend a day or two on a different, whether it be study, or we had Stewie Lowe working as in his progressive property business, and we had other guys. It was some really good examples of guys. Andrew Thompson still working on different things. So there was some really good examples of guys working outside of football. But that's certainly, as the next 5 years, that transitioned into, you know, you're there every day. You're there from 7 till at least 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And the way I explain it to people is that whilst they're shorter days and shorter time periods, the intensity whilst you're there is a lot greater than an everyday work life. The intensity while you're there, you're on and you're competing and you're pushing yourself harder and further than you were yesterday. So that's the difference, I reckon, between a normal commercial office life versus the AFL footballer. Whilst the days are shorter, the intensity is greater. So it does offset itself. In saying that, there is still opportunity to look elsewhere and certainly develop yourself further.
In commercial life, Jase, obviously meetings are a part of the business world, but increasingly so they've become part of football. And a lot of the players I've spoken to on this program and just chatting over the years say that's the one thing that wears them down after a while. It's meeting after meeting and just everything is dissected to the most minute detail. Did that get to you towards the end?
Absolutely. When I first started, we didn't have behind the goals footage, believe it or not. Mm. When that came into play, it certainly opened up the whole spectrum of analysis, and you were able to really drill down, dissect, three or four moves ahead of the play. But for me, it is demanding. But what it is, it's football analysis and smart. So you're doing a football degree in that respect, and the resources are there now. As much as you want, you can achieve and unlock and have access to. So whereas times before you were limited with resources, now you have unlimited resources. So the expectation is that you use those resources and try and drive your football, whether it's analysing your opponent or analysing how you could make better decisions under pressure, or analysing a different role that you potentially may play that week, those resources are available. So the expectation is that you use all of those hours committed during the day to enhance your football.
How much of that knowledge that comes through those meetings and the tapes and all of the sort of things that you look at make a difference when you're 5 points down or 5 points up at the 25-minute mark of the last quarter? Does it actually make a difference? Do you go back to that point in time and say, this is the structure, this is what we have to do, or is the pressure of the moment something that just has a life of its own?
I like to think of it as principles. One of the things that I learned and only really got probably mid my career is it's based on principles. So a principle then will drive a behaviour or your decision making. So, depending on the game scenario, the scoreboard, depending on, if it's the conditions and time of the game, all those factors put together have an underlying principle that will say, okay, we really need to put a man back in defence, or we need to really press forward and put the pressure on whilst we can, or we need to slow the play down. We've been going for 15 minutes with great intensity. We need to give ourselves a couple of minutes to take stock and go again. So, Ross Lyon really was a great influencer and coach in that respect. He really came down. When Ross came in, he brought all those principles with him that perhaps we hadn't concentrated on in the past.
I'll ask you about your coaches a little bit later on, and we've spoken about the fact that you were involved in the business world before you finished footy. What are you doing now?
So working for a company called Fraser's Property in their retail arm, project managing shopping centre developments. So looking after a site down in Burwood behind the RSPCA, and it's all going well, but really enjoying it. It's a... the team environment that I talked about before, we do have some elements in that, and we're all driving for an end date. We have a large consultant team, we have a builder who's had a team behind them, and we have the Frasers team. So I do enjoy those elements because it's been entrenched in me in the last 20 years.
How much involvement in footy do you have these days?
Very limited these days. I get to enjoy the Saints on the weekend.
And just finally, before we take a break, you say you... still love the Saints and you watch them wherever you can. How do you think they're tracking at the moment? They started the season so well and exceeded everybody's expectations, I think, early in the season, but there's been a bit of a reality check after that. How would you assess what they've done so far?
We're seeing some really talented young guys coming through. One of the biggest criticisms of the Saints last year was their effort, and I think they've really addressed that this year. I think their effort... has been fantastic. Their pressure and their attack on the ball has been really pleasing to see. I think considering the injuries they've had as well and the setbacks, they've done extraordinary work this year.
We've touched on the beginning of your football journey, and we'll touch on it a little bit more when we come back on the other side of the break. Jason Blake is my guest on This Is Your Sporting Life at Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives, and we'll have more with Jace coming up after the break.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hope you're enjoying the chat with Jason Blake on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Jace, you spoke about the period when you were drafted. Take us back before that and your early steps in footy. Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Mentone in Bayside in Melbourne, and football was I kind of fell into football really. I was playing throughout school and doing okay, and then I was picked up by the Dragons, kind of a last pick really, and then from there did the right things. That was Paran Dragons back in the. Mm-hmm. Back in the day that are now Sandy, but I was okay without being anything great, and really didn't know much about football other than just having fun and having a kick out there. And once I joined the Dragons, I was able to be mentored by a couple of the senior guys there, and really decided to extend. I might start that again, actually.
Yeah, sure. That's all right.
Started rambling on.
Yeah, no, that's okay. That's fine. What we might do is, because that was the first question, so I'll start the segment again.
Yeah.
Good. Okay. I'll just stop that so we got an accurate. Probably lost about a minute there, but that's okay. Absolutely. All right. Hope you're enjoying the chat with Jason Blake on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives. Jace, you spoke about being drafted. Take us back a little bit before that. What were your early steps in footy? Where did you grow up?
So I grew up in Mentone in Bayside, Melbourne. And football to me, I really fell into it. It's something that just developed. Whilst it was a dream, I saw AFL players and I went to many games, but I don't know. It wasn't really on my radar early on until it started to become a reality in my later teen years.
Were you a Saints fan, being Bayside lad?
It was funny. My father was a Saints supporter, but I was Essendon.
Oh, righto.
Influenced by his best mate at the time, but so I still had a close affiliation with the Saints. Obviously, being around the corner, down the road from Rabin, St Kilda was certainly a soft spot for me, and so I went into the Sandown Round Dragons and was kind of the last pick, to be honest, under 16s, and that kind of followed, that trend kind of followed with the final few picks for Victorian squads, and I guess that realization that this could become a reality set in later in those years, and then I started working a lot harder and paired up with a couple of senior players at the Dragons, and then I felt from then on it just kind of accelerated my development, and went through the big squads and then All Australian, and lucky enough to get picked up by the Saints at in the second round, which I thought I was going to. I had it's a funny story that I had many meetings with Choco Williams and Port Adelaide, and they said if you're still around at pick 25. We'll take you up. Had a 5-minute chat with Johnny Beveridge, the famous St Kilda recruiter, and he said, "Look, we know what Jason. We know you can do, mate." And that was about it. And so I thought I was going to Port Adelaide, and then Saints picked me up, which was overwhelming. Really, it was something so exciting and so great that I had all my family and friends there at the time. And unfortunately, it was recorded, so you could see.
does that recording get pulled out every now and again?
It's been around a few times. It's some seriously poor dress sense at the time. it's heading to the Saints. It was quite like I said. I went for Essendon as a kid, and then have Tim Watson as a coach. It was quite bizarre. But coming into the Saints realm and seeing these players, looking back, I almost wanted to kick my younger self because I was pretty ignorant to it all and really immature at that stage and unaware of what it took to become an AFL player.
Oh, well, that's what they say, isn't it? The value of 20/20 hindsight's the best vision you could ever have. But when you talk about what you know as a youngster compared to what you know now, it'd be lovely to have that knowledge.
Well, I was failing terribly. I was turning up late for meetings. I just didn't really quite get it, and then Stewie Lowe pulled me aside and said, "Mate, you need to really have a look at yourself here. We want you to be part of this team, but you need to really come." Well, so we set some rules and some agendas, and from there, it was really the kick in the guts that I needed to realise that this is going to come and go really quickly if I don't start focusing on what I can on training and effort and discipline. And commitment and sacrifice, all those things that make it great. From then on, I really became a competitive, beast in that regard and wanted to do things and beat all the other guys. And so that was an amazing kind of time in my life of growing up and understanding what it took to be a professional athlete.
You mentioned some of the personnel that arrived there round about the same time. Rui arrives in the draft and the nucleus was there, but it was a tough struggle for the football club when you first got there. They weren't a winning team. Is there an attitude that exists in a team like that that you almost get used to losing?
Yeah, it was a horrible time. I remember that first year. I remember hating it, to be honest. It was, you know, I came into the AFL and they had completed this, you know, torturous preseason that and then now we're losing every week. We're getting absolutely hammered for it. Tim was saying, well, I remember one of his lines is, if you didn't want to put in effort during the game, we're going to put in effort and train during the week, and we'll start at six, and it would be torturous sessions. And of course, that just had a negative effect because we were completely tired and over and buggered for the weekend. So it was this quicksand of effort and losses, and so it was. Whilst it was tough, it certainly there was a breaking point, I guess, at the end of the year when Tim left and we had the famous Malcolm Blight come in. And for him to come in, I remember one of his first addresses to the team was, "Okay, guys, I've got this covered. The flood, don't worry about the flood. I've got that covered. Don't worry about X, Y, Z. You guys are going to be, you know, top four side." And then to look back on the events that occurred after that was quite bizarre. But there were times that were, you know, like I said, you look back now and you think, how did this happen, really? And it wasn't until Grant Thomas came on the scene that we had some stability. And with Grant, he really gave us a pathway, a roadmap, and taught us the basics about footy and what we need to really concentrate on. And just so happened that with Grant, we had those drafts of Rui and Cozzy, and then, you know, Nick Dalsano, Luke Ball, Matt Maguire, Xavier Clark, Lee Montagna. It's funny talking about, you know, Blighty, the recruitment of Blighty, for whatever it was, it probably was an error. But in that regard, with Blighty came Fraser Garrick, Aaron Hamill, Stevie Lawrence, Stephen Powell. So these type of players came into our side because we had a headline coach with Blighty, and those guys, specifically with Fraser and Hamill, really gave us a great benchmark and leadership for all us younger guys coming through.
So things were beginning to turn at the football club. That losing attitude, if you like, was starting to disappear, and it wasn't long before the team was making finals and getting close to getting into grand finals. Did you feel as though the window was there in the mid-2000s, that the premiership was just around the corner?
Absolutely. I mean, we at 2004 preliminary final against Port Adelaide, where we lost by 5 points, and I mean, that game will be etched into my mind. I think if we went on the next week, we would have taken that. I mean, I think it was Brisbane. We're up.
Yes.
We knew we had Brisbane's measure, and we're going into that game, into the Port Adelaide game. We're a number of goals up. We had the momentum, and that's, of course, where the famous Fraser Garrick kicked his 100th. And it felt like from that point on, the whole momentum shifts towards Port Adelaide, and Gavin Wagoner played one of the best quarters I've seen. Kicked 3 goals from the pocket, and they clinched it by 5 points. So I mean, during those early years, we had some amazing players, and that belief was really starting to build. That obviously went into 2005, but again, I think we're up by at three-quarter time against Sydney, and then they rolled us again. And for whatever reason, after that prelim final, expectations, well, we may have had some people leave when injured, but we kind of dropped off that belief, and for the next couple of years, it was a bit of a grind. until Ross.
Is that because there are two ways of looking at that sort of situation? When you come that close, you think, oh, we're knocking on the door. But then the other side of the coin is you think, we've bloody missed an opportunity here. In fact, we've missed two.
Yeah, it's devastating to really think about. Those two opportunities, it seemed like we were so close but so far away. We by all rights, we probably didn't have the maturity as a side to get us there. We could have stolen it, though. We could have. I mean, that potential, those years against particularly the one that put Adelaide one in Brisbane, that was one that really got away. But looking about how then we transitioned into the years of Ross Lyon, we really, looking back at it now, you really think the game plan and the structure and the strategies, potentially we were lacking in those areas. Whilst the effort and the intensity and the general play that we had with under Grant was good, Ross took us to that kind of next level of structure and strategy and setups and football smarts and team kind of play.
And that next level would eventually take you to three grand finals in 2 years. And we'll talk about that when we come back on the other side of the break with Jason Blake, my guest on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Hope you're enjoying the chat with Jason Blake on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. We spoke about those prelim finals, Jase, in 2004, 2005, 2008. We get to 2009 and that attitude that perhaps something big might be about to happen. You talked about that great game between St Kilda and Geelong in the middle of the season. Did you feel as though that you were head and shoulders the best two teams that year?
I truly feel we did. We were used to benchmark Geelong as that team to beat. I mean, they were so great in those last previous years. And I mean, when Ross came in, I feel the last 10 years of our development as a team, with the guys, that core group of guys, you talk about Rue and Nick Delson, that maturity, it all came to a head when Ross really came to the club. I feel we're driving the club and the actions. We're taking control of our standards and buying in as a team and as players. We have a limited time here. We've got a good group of guys that are really talented. But if we don't start driving this and the players start driving this, we're going to miss our opportunity. So, 2007, 2008 saw us really come through a journey that left. You know, we saw Robert Harvey leave. And we saw some of these greats leave without a premiership. And as tragic as it was, it certainly focused our attention to the fact that we have a limited time. We're going to do everything we can in our power to make this opportunity come to life. So 2008 was a real turning point for us. We saw what Geelong were doing, and we thought we could certainly match them and take it one step further. So coming to that game, we're 13 wins each. We'd watch them every week, and we truly believed this was our time. And that game was, the intensity of that game was phenomenal, and it was paramount to a final for us. The goings on of that game was truly spectacular.
I think it probably convinced everybody outside that you were the two best teams as well, and that it was a flip of the coin job once you got to the big day, and that's the way it turned out. What are your memories of the day? Because I think we have this picture in our mind's eye of grand final day always being a nice sunny day, but it certainly wasn't in 2009. It was a slog.
It was a slog, and we missed some opportunities early on that would eventually be our detriment. And but I mean, going into that, you know, to get through the preliminary final was just elation for all of us, and to actually play in a grand final was a incredible experience. The lead up to it, and obviously the grand final parade, and then watching Moorabbin just come to life with supporters flooding the stands, and really support the whole town, really coming to life down the Bayside area and supporting us, was phenomenal. Obviously the drought that has driven St Kilda fans mad for the last, you know, how many years?
Well, 66. So.
The whole premise was there in front of us, and the opportunity was real. So
did that hang over your head a little bit? The fact that everybody talked about the drought and talked about 66 and the fact that it had been 43 years, was that something that the players felt at any stage?
You certainly knew, and you're certainly aware of it. But on the other side, you certainly understood if you would be legend status if you get through this game and take this out, you'd be immortalised into St Kilda's history, and that certainly excited me, and it excited many of the players when we talked about, you know, this is real, here we go, we've got this, and that day it really was an arm wrestle. It was always going to be an arm wrestle. It was a battle. We're at war with each other. And that game was intense. We missed opportunities. We came back, but it just felt at the end of the day, their experience in that environment got them through.
And that toe poke from Matty Scarlett, and it goes down the other end, and Chappie kicks the goal, and you had a pretty good view of all of that.
Yes, I was fingertips away from smothering that ball, and. You look at it, and a lot of what ifs in that last quarter, but it was devastating. It was absolutely devastating, and to see a bunch of grown men cry is not pretty. But their rooms were filled with tears, and you know, everyone was terribly upset. The worst part of it that I can't understand and believe is that we then had to go. we had the dinner already formalised and already set up. So we had to compose ourselves, get us everyone together, and then go down into the Crown Palladium and have a grand final dinner amongst the supporters. And the feeling in that room was just morbid. It was so, I'll never forget it. It was terrible. But it was an experience, a very unique experience that I guess I was fortunate to get through, and that led obviously to 2010.
Yeah, and you mentioned the room being filled with tears in 2009. The room was filled with something else, but we'll talk about that as we discuss 2010. So the premiership window is still open. You go through 2010, you set up the date with Collingwood. Everybody who was there that day remembers the feeling on the final siren. And it's the most nothing feeling that you could experience as a spectator. I can only imagine what it must be like as a player.
I actually didn't know what the rules were for a drawn grand final. So I'm looking around and wondering what's happening next. It was, like you talked about, bizarre feeling. It was soulless. I just didn't understand. Your mind and your headspace for a grand final is that there is no tomorrow. That's there is no tomorrow. So you are driving yourself to deliver an output that there is no tomorrow. So you're going to give everything you can. And as soon as that changes, you don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And like you said, it was a very unique and bizarre feeling.
How many times have you watched Milne's kick and thought, if only?
There's a couple of if onlys in that game. Again, I hadn't watched it until recently, end of last year, actually. And when I was going on to panel, I knew I was going to get asked these questions. So, oh, geez, I better watch this game again. And And one of the things I took out of it was just the intensity of that first quarter. I've never experienced an intensity in that first quarter as I did in that grand final. I remember coming to the quarter time thinking, geez, I don't know if I can keep going here at this rate. I'm going to keel over. But that toe poke, it just seemed so cruel. As a St Kilda player and watching as a fan, it just doesn't seem right. And, you know, I was very close. I went into the ruck, so I was right there and amongst it. And to Ben Johnson then to clear that ball, I remember I was only a couple of metres away as well. And watching it is soul-destroying, unfortunately.
Mm. And then that feeling that we were talking about, and it was exacerbated by those remarkable circumstances. You're out on the ground, you don't know what to do. Just one question about that. Would you have preferred on the day to have played extra time and get it done and dusted then and there?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it was the right decision by the AFL changing that rule. I guess they probably hadn't really thought about it up until that point and the impacts of that rule. But
well, Maxie, in that famous interview after the siren, said, "This is ridiculous. You know,
yeah,
this shouldn't be happening."
Wedding plans had to change.
Yeah.
It was incredible to hear about the aftermath of that result. But from a player's point of view, we would have ideally played on and played a couple of 5 minute halves or the like. It just seemed like a natural thing to do to play overtime in that environment. But it is what it is, and unfortunately, we just couldn't compose ourselves afterwards. We went away after that game. We got together we went actually to Rui's pub in Brighton Hotel and took out the top level and had a sit down with the players and the Sean Richardson, who was the psych at the time, talked to us about what's next and how your mind, you're going to a grieving process, almost the fact that you need to get yourself back up. You prepared your mind mentally to give it your all, and this is going to be your last game. Blah, blah, blah. You need to get yourself back up and think about preparation and think about how am I going to be at the level to give my all the next week. So it was a really strange week. You know, we had guys with injuries. We had a lot of excuses, but at the end of the day, we just couldn't get ourselves back up to the level that we needed to.
All right, we're going to move on to our final break. When we come back on the other side of the break, I want to mention the Brownlow Medal, so you know what's coming. Okay. We'll talk about that with Jason Blake when we come back on the other side of the break. This is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Welcome back to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Our final segment with Jason Blake on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives. Now, Jace, we've spoken about grand finals. Unfortunately, we can't talk about a premiership because that didn't eventuate for you. But the Brownlow Medal.
You've
got an association with the Brownlow Medal that a lot of people know about, but some people might not know about. What's your association with the Brownlow?
For me, I think the Brownlow is very overrated.
Yeah. Why would that be?
Well, potentially I could hold the record for the most games played without a Brownlow vote.
How many of those games did you play without a Brownlow vote?
So it was 12 years, and I think it was about 210 games.
Did it just become a bit comical after a while?
It's something I hope doesn't remain on my tombstone when it's all said and done, but unfortunately it probably will. I like to think I was the fourth best player on the ground
yes.
in most of those games.
Yeah. And the umpires just have no idea.
Well, yes, some would say that. it certainly was a long time coming, and the guys really picked it up and used and played with it toward those final years. So
now, where were you when that vote was read out?
I had some friends come over, and
did you think you'd get a vote that day? You probably thought you'd get a vote prior to that, but did you think you'd get a vote that day?
I thought I was a chance, yeah. And so I mean the lead up to it was ridiculous. I mean we had I'm fairly close with Nick Delsano, and him mentioning on the Brownlow night the year before was staggering, so that really built it up to 2012, I think, when I against the Gold Coast, so to get the Brownlow vote, and then I think it's the first and only time I was trending in the Twitter space. But it was one of those things.
Do you know the name of the player who had the record before you?
I think Lee Brown had it before me.
I think it was Ross Henshaw. Did you ever actually crack it for an invite to the Brownlow?
I didn't. I've never been.
Geez, surely there should be a category. I mean, you should be invited every year now simply because of this.
I don't know if I want to go. I might have to avoid that. I'm not sure.
It's just one of those sideshows anyway. But you've got your Brownlow votes, so that's the most important thing. When you got to the end of your career, were you done? Were you cooked?
It's funny. It's because having Ross leave, Scott Waters came in. At that stage, I was still hungry. I was still excited to play, but the Saints were going through a transition period, and I was completely of the understanding that if I was going to play, I needed to be three times better than the young guy coming through, because we're going to be 5 years, at least 5 years, still we have a run at this premiership. So you know, the reality of it all was, I was understanding of and accepting, really. And so I managed to get another couple of years under Scott, but he came to me and he said, mate, this is it. This is, you're done. Hope you know you're done. I go, yep, I know I'm done. Fair enough. But I got to leave the game, and it's one of my most favourite games with Stephen Milne and Justin Kaczynski. So against Freo, against Ross, that final game where he rested, it's a bit infamous, where he rested a number of his players so they could play in the finals. And that game was great. I was get to run through the banner with my daughter and had all my family and friends there. And then at the end of the game, like during the game, it was bizarre. Like guys were looking for myself, Cozzy or Milne to give it to and get us involved in the game. It was like a training run, really, where they're going, no, that option's free, but no, and then kind of signalling to us to go. And it truly was a kind of a magical afternoon for all three of us.
Was that the time when Cozzy at training had his GPS swapped with someone else just to make the numbers look a bit better so that he'd get picked?
He did. He swapped it with Lee Mondaniel.
That's right.
And then refused to wear the bib as he changed bib as he walked through ran through the banner. So some funny stories leading up to that day. It really was. You don't have too many games where you really enjoy yourself. At the end of the game, it's more a relief that you've won and you've played well. And the best part of football is that 10 minutes in the locker rooms after you've won a game, getting around each other and bathing in that success. And then you've got to turn your focus to the next week. So it was one of the great games that I'll never forget, and to leave the game with those two good players that I've played all my career with and really good mates, it was quite special.
A great way to bow out. My final question, 219 games for a bloke who was last picked in the teams, as you were saying, at junior level. You must be pretty proud that you squeezed every last drop out of the lemon.
It's one of the things that that was really drilled into us by the older guys is to have no regrets. As long as you look back and you can look yourself in the mirror and say, look, you have to give it your all, because it will just churn your guts if you don't give it your all, and you've wasted opportunities. I feel I feel I did that. I felt like I gave my all and had no regrets. So it is a nice feeling to look back and look back at it with a really enjoyable sense and a pleasant feeling that the St Kilda Football Club was a magical time for me and to now impress that on the younger guys coming forward to really embrace that.
It's been a great pleasure to sit back and relive those 219 games and some of the highlights and the lowlights, and in particular those Brownlow votes that we'll never forget.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Good on you, Jase. Jason Blake joining us on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funeral, celebrating lives. We'll be back with another great of Australian sport same time next week. I hope you can join us then.
Want to witness the world's biggest football game? Head to iCanWin.com.au, predict Australia's score with a crystal ball, and it could be you and a friend at the FIFA World Cup Qatar 2022 semi-finals, all thanks to McDonald's. Maccas, together and loving it. TNCs apply.